anything secret. It's
yeah, in the paper. Yeah.
You're gonna keep your hand down, Rick.
This is now a new sound roll 66 and camera roll 138, and we're interviewing Lionel Steinberg, Fighting the Fields. Take one.
First, yeah.
Okay, shall we go?
Do it,
please.
Rolling.
Okay, this is Lionel Steinberg. Take one, marker.
Mr. Steinberg, let's actually start with that story you were just telling me a minute ago. In 1969, the boycott was in full swing, and you and Howard Margolis went back to talk to A&P. Tell me that story.
The boycott was probably the most effective boycott in labor history, in my opinion, partly because of the zeal of the people involved, but as much because of the Vietnam War. I think people were wanted a cause, and the cause was don't eat grapes. So Caesar had the advantage of thousands of students who were anti-war, and they needed something to tie into on a day-to-day basis, and boycotting grapes was a good one. So he was able to put groups in the major cities and to intimidate management of the major chains, whose names I won't bother to mention, but every chain you've ever heard of, he was able to intimidate them into taking grapes off the shelves. And he would threaten them and say, look, if you don't take these grapes off the shelves, we're going to tear your store apart and keep your customers out. Well, grapes in the 60s were just one of maybe 100 commodities in a chain store, which they felt they could do without. So they pragmatically acquiesced and threw the growers to the wolves, which we felt was not fair. It was a secondary boycott, and one we felt was not altogether justified. So Howard Margolis and I went to New York City to try to talk to the head of one of the major chains of the United States, whose name I won't mention at this moment, and we sat down with him and said, we're going to go broke. You know, there's 100,000 acres of grapes, 100,000 jobs, and you've got to give us some help, stop this boycott. So the guy said to us, now put yourself in my position. If we put the grapes on the shelves, what happens? Some of the fanatics working for the union come into the stores with razor blades and cut open the flour sacks and the sugar sacks and dump over the canned goods and hand out leaflets in the front and intimidate people and keep them out of our stores. And he said, frankly, there's not much I can do about it. Why don't you go out and try to make peace with the union? And that was the end of that meeting. So I came back and in 69 and tried, with the help of Monsignor Mahoney, to in Fresno, the fall of 69, to reach some sort of an agreement, because Caesar had told the National Bishops Committee, some six or seven national bishops, that he was willing to take any grower, if they would get a contract. So the bishop said, took him at his word. They said, well, here's Steinberg, he's ready to go. So we had a meeting in Bakersfield that got nowhere with the help of just one minister, and I was pretty discouraged. So the spring of 70, the bishops tried one more time to see if they could get me to give it another go-round. So I reluctantly agreed, but I said to the bishops that there's only one way I'm willing to sit down and try to negotiate. If you stay in the room and help me write the contract and see that we have fair play on both sides. So we agreed to meet in a motel at the LA airport with these six bishops, and we met day and night for 2 days. And as I recall, it was a hectic meeting. I was there, and one other person with me, and the union had 8 or 10 people, and there were 6 bishops there and so forth. And we made very, very little progress. So by midnight, the bishops were killing 1 or 2 bottles of scotch, and it was almost morning before we ever reached pretty close to an agreement that I said I would accept, and Caesar said he would accept.
Well, let me jump in here. You had run a business, a farm, a ranch.
My family had been growing grapes in the state of California since the 1920s.
Yeah, so you were, okay, so let's pick up here.
This happens to be in my 50th year myself, I think.
Lionel Steinberg, take 2.
Let's go down a little bit. Yeah. Yes, roll in.
Okay, this is take 2, marker.
Now, you signed a contract. You were the first person to sign. What kind of response did you get from the other growers in the grape industry?
To put it politely, they were chagrined and quite upset about it.
Cut for just a second. We're not going to use any of my questions in the interview, so how did
Lionel Steinberg, take 3 up.
The other growers were...
We have to start over again.
Wait, let him get the phone.
Okay, this is take 3, marker.
How did the other growers react?
Well, the other growers were shocked.
One more time, please.
Good.
And chagrined.
Let's start one more time. He was walking in front of the camera.
Ask the question.
How did the other growers react?
They were shocked and chagrined.
I need you to say.
And felt that.
Excuse me, come on.
Rick, just let him go.
Yeah,
on.
Go ahead.
That perhaps they were losing their fight against the union.
And in fact, they were, weren't they?
They were. So what happened, much to my surprise,
we're doing Lionel Steinberg 4.
After I signed, the immediate response was that
hey,
the...
No, we're not on yet.
Okay.
You're ahead of
just keep it going.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Hold it. Rolling.
This is take 4, marker.
Okay.
The immediate response from the other growers was dismay, and they were chagrined and concerned that perhaps the union was going to take over. But to my pleasant surprise, and it was very unexpected, we found that 6 or 8 of the major chain stores and produce houses in Canada began calling us wanting our grapes and our brand because we had the union bug. So we had an immediate advantage over our competitors of $1 or $2 a box, which was a fringe benefit I really never expected. And once the growers saw that my grapes were the only ones they wanted, they rushed to get in the act. So the first grower that decided that if this is good enough for Steinberg, we better get in it too, was Keene Larson and his wife, Corky Larson.
And it snowballed. Now, the other side of the coin is that once you signed, your operations were changed. How did having a contract affect what you did in the fields?
Well, you had to work with a ranch committee.
I need to grab your glasses.
You had to work with the ranch committee, which through the 20-odd years of our experience has been, they were hardcore, arrogant people who were not what you would call rank-and-file workers. They started out rank-and-file, and they gradually became union pros who were anti-grower and had more of the attitude of the hierarchy of the United Farm Workers. So it became more and more difficult to achieve productivity and quality control and so forth. So it made my job much more difficult. And then they demanded that no non-union supervisor could even talk to the workers. Then they reluctantly said, well, they can at least communicate, but they're not to carry a pruning shear in their hand or a grape clipper.
Well, let me jump in. If things then became difficult, you had a chance to get out in 73, and everyone else left the UFW and you didn't. Why did you stay?
I suppose you could say it was three quarters philosophical, and secondly, to be practical, if a vote were going to be taken, my workers would have voted for the union, so I couldn't have won an election if I wanted to. So I was really in a position where I had few alternatives, either economically or politically or philosophically.
Well, philosophically is one thing, but the other folks who signed with the Teamsters didn't hold elections. They just said, we're going with the Teamsters. You could have done that.
I could have. In fact, I was approached by the Teamsters and didn't do anything with them. Because I felt that the UFW had more allegiance to the workers than the Teamsters did. But I'd say over the 25 years experience with the union, been more disappointments than attributes and pleasant things.
Well, let's talk about the next big phase, 1975, the ALRB. Did you think that that was a good solution to the problem?
If Jerry Brown had put in a well-balanced ALRB instead of packing it with pro-union people, I think the growers would have trusted it. But Jerry Brown packed the ALRB with all votes that were going to go in the direction of UFW, and then I suppose to compound the problem, although I had an academic reputation in agriculture and one of being involved in agriculture for a lifetime, when Jerry Brown appointed me president of the State Board of Agriculture, that wasn't too well received by growers either, because they knew I had the only contract with Chavez, and here Brown was making me president of the State Board of Agriculture.
Let's stop a minute. We have to change film. These magazines run for 11 minutes, and we put in a new piece of film.
I'm going to run the washroom one.
We're changing to sound roll. I mean, we're changing to camera roll one, camera roll 60, camera roll 137. No, camera roll 139. Next up is Lionel Steinberg, take 5.
Take 5, marker.
Mr. Steinberg, give me some personal responses or recollections of Cesar Chavez.
I met Cesar and knew something about him all during the 1960s. I followed his career and the predecessor that was a farm workers union, mostly led by Filipinos, that he ended up taking over. And I'd say we met in passing on a few occasions, but never had any substantial conferences to the late 60s.
But how did he strike you as a human being once you met him?
I felt that Cesar was a noteworthy person with little formal education, but a great deal of acumen and common sense, and more than anything else, a great intensity and a desire to prevail and succeed and achieve what he thought were the proper goals for farm workers.
his public image was as a man of peace and nonviolence. Do you think that was an image, or do you think he really was like that?
I think it was about... it was more image than fact. I think that he either acquiesced or was aware that the Union was willing to use as tough methods as the Teamsters or the growers, and were just as willing to engage in physical confrontations, so that the Mahatma Gandhi image was great in terms of Americana, and it served its purpose. But I question whether he was uncomfortable with the way he actually performed.
But you talk about his image. You know, Caesar was closely linked with the Kennedys, who you were associated with, and a lot of what happened in the 60s and 70s was a question of image, wasn't it?
Please repeat that question.
Caesar was closely linked to Bobby Kennedy and Ethel, and you had some connection with the Kennedy family, too. Wasn't what farmworkers did, wasn't the controlling the image important?
Well, Caesar came along during the Vietnam era, and that was an era, as we all know, of great distress to, if not the majority of young people, at least a considerable number of young people who felt that it was the wrong war being fought the wrong way, and now even McNamara laments that he encouraged the war.
So Caesar offered them a good
battle. So Caesar offered them a good, clean, allegedly a good, clean, wholesome American goal. Let's kick those rich growers around and help the poor farm workers get a better standard of living. So he did have a very important appeal to young people who were well-intentioned, and rightly so.
Well, if you thought there were so many problems with working with the union, tell me why you stuck with them and you still have a union contract today. Why did you stay so long?
Well, I think I first went with the union at the behest of Ted Kennedy and the late Congressman Phil Burton and Monsignor Roger Mahoney. And a few farm workers I knew, Filipino farm workers I knew, that felt there was a place for a union among farm workers. So I'd say philosophically and intellectually, I shared some of their views, not all their views. I didn't share their techniques or their methods.
But that was the start. You stuck it out for 25 years.
I suppose you might call that Steinberg tenacity, and maybe in that degree I was just as stubborn as Caesar. I was reluctant to perhaps admit I made a mistake and to start all over again. And I don't know if my reputation as a so-called liberal was important to me or not, but it had some pleasantness, but it certainly wasn't something that ruled my economic decision making.
Well, when all this started in the 60s, did you think that farm workers needed to be unionized?
Yes, I felt that farm workers needed to be unionized as early as the early 1950s. I made a recommendation to former Governor Earl Warren that they start considering decent housing for farm workers and adequate labor camps and better conditions, toilets.
And a union was part of that.
And the unions were part of that. And I did admire through the years, of course, Franklin Roosevelt and Francis Perkins and the history of unionism, I felt the time had come, perhaps, for a good union operation to come into agriculture. Unfortunately, Chavez had the opportunity. He might have had 100 or 200,000 farm workers if he'd been more willing to listen to more experienced leaders within organized labor, such as George Meany, who offered to give him experienced trade union people to help establish organizations throughout California. But Caesar adamantly said, we're going to do it my way. And his way was with priests and nuns who frequently had miniskirts, not that I'm opposed to miniskirts, and hundreds and hundreds of Ivy League students who were out here for the fun of fighting the growers, and some Protestant ministers and a few rabbis. And Caesar failed to take advantage of the his early victories, which is unfortunate in terms of labor and Caesar and the workers.
Let's cut for a second.
Review. Get to the end,
yeah.
The question about the disappointment.
Yeah. Actually, we were looking for old footage, and I saw an interview that was done. Let's roll on.
This is Lionel Steinberg. Take six up, camera 139. Yes.
Take six, marker.
Ironically enough, the signing of my contract made the front pages of the Miami newspapers, Washington, D.C., New York Times, the Alaska papers, the L.A. Times, and it was considered a historic occasion, and I was hopeful that Chavez was going to achieve my highest expectations. So I was very optimistic and hopeful that things were going to go very well, and they didn't.
And when you talked earlier about a sense of disappointment, is that what you're referring to?
Yes, I felt that he could have taken a totally different tack. He could have accepted the help of George Meany and other leaders in the AFL-CIO and professionalized and formed a trade union rather than a social revolutionary movement, with its base being priests and nuns and students that came and went. There was no continuity to them. Every year you'd have a new group of antagonists. There was not a continuous relationship, which some unions have for 10 and 15 and 20 years.
And that's what you think really is needed to make things work?
That's what he needed to achieve the confidence and the respect of the other growers that subsequently signed, because they felt that we don't want to sign, but now that we have, let's hope we've got a good relationship. So they were probably angrier than I was, and certainly vastly more disappointed than I.
But even though you've charted your own course, your feelings are certainly representative of the industry, aren't they, in this regard?
I don't quite follow your question.
I'm saying you're disappointed, but they were even more disappointed, so you're in step with everybody else on this.
I think I have to go back to what I said were his overall achievements. One, he brought dignity to the individual farm worker. A worker was a name rather than a number of a person. Two, he brought better housing conditions. And three, he brought sanitary conditions to the fields. And four, he brought higher wages. And five, he brought some recognition of seniority rights. And to me, those are all very important to the individual farm worker. And I feel that those are the pluses, and of course the minuses were he failed as a builder of a great union.
ID for debt and cassette. This has been interview with Lionel Steinberg for Fight in the Fields, Paradigm Productions, and it's a continuing interview with on Sound Roll 66 and Tamro 139. Next up is Wild Track 1006, room tone for Steinberg interview.
Well, some of the brainiest people left.
Okay, and end of interview with Lionel Steinberg and end of Sound Roll 66. Sound Roll 66.
Those people left in disbanding.